Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:01 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is November 8th, and it certainly wasn't short of fireworks in here today. So, Bitcoin is down $2,400, and this period of very inert trading wasn't going to last indefinitely. And now we've seen that there's been a significant deterioration. I think it's worth highlighting that there are a number of consistency characteristics that are now under severe duress. I think perhaps the most important is that the 1,000-day moving average had been an area of potential support and actual support on several occasions over the course of the last decade, and now the price has been ranging below the 1,000-day moving average for more time than at any point in the cryptocurrency's entire history. So that's an inconsistency. Then we have the additional inconsistency that on each of the occasions when Bitcoin has gone sideways, then every single time, each one of those ranges has been above the last. And they've never dipped down into the underlying range, but it is now dipping down into that underlying range because the peak back in 2017 was at the high was 19,500, and we're closing out the day at 18,218. So that's a significant issue that we're dipping down into the underlying range. So now you have two really quite significant trend inconsistencies. And the problem, of course, is that Bitcoin does not have a verifiable or arguably doesn't really have fundamentals. It's mostly a supply inelasticity argument supplemented by the promise at some point in the future of alternative finance. So there's obviously the there are very polarized arguments about the upside or the downside. Therefore, we really should just pay attention to what people are actually doing with their money. And then we can think about one of the causes behind today's volatility, which are fresh shenanigans in the exchanges for cryptocurrencies. Between the jigs and the reels, I suspect that what we've seen today is that the CEO of Binance engineered the decline of FTX and then, in cahoots with the CEO, was able to engineer a very low takeover offer for FTX by beefing up all of the talk about issues with liquidity. So that has further concentrated the market in the hands of Binance and then subsequently has contributed to a great deal of volatility. So then let's look at Ethereum, which has been outperforming but was also down in a rather dynamic manner in here today. So down 260 on a price of 1300, we're talking about a decline of 20%. It doesn't look like much on the chart right now because of the extent of the volatility. But then there's, so that was the story that was making the headlines. But there is the additional issue that alternative asset managers have been receiving capital calls, and we don't have a lot of visibility on exactly what kind of alternatives asset managers have been invested in. So there's the natural assumption that they were income-producing type opportunities. Lots of alternatives have got very lengthy lockup. And I was speaking with an alternatives manager yesterday who just happened to be trying to pitch me. But what he was basically saying was that there were some of the funds that he had access to had 10-year lockups. So when those types of funds ask for additional capital, then endowments and pension funds don't have a lot of option. They have to invest. They might be investing in resorts, they might be investing in large commercial properties, or they might be investing in an entire hotel chain. And Then what do you do when they need additional cash? You can't very well sell it overnight. And then cash has to be found from somewhere. So then you sell things that aren't performing as well. Well, perhaps some of the volatility that we're now seeing in the cryptocurrency markets is because of liquidity issues, but perhaps not the kind of liquidity issues that we're accustomed to. It might simply be a barometer again of global liquidity. And that's been my way of thinking about cryptocurrencies for the last few years, is that they were a barometer of risk-taking behavior and global liquidity. And we know that global liquidity is deteriorating. Interest rates have been rising aggressively, money supply has been contracting, and the dollar has been exceptionally strong. So all three of those factors have contributed to a contraction in global liquidity. And I thought it was particularly interesting today that Bitcoin was especially weak on the same day that the dollar index made a new reaction low. So it didn't finish on the low of the day, but we're down 3 consecutive days. And there have been 3 downside key reversals in the last 6 weeks and a big downward dynamic on Friday. So there's certainly a softening up process underway. One thing that I'm going to post a chart of it today, but it's that the interest rate differential between the dollar and the euro has only ever been above 250 basis points once in the last 23 years, and that was right at the end of the TMT bubble in 1999. Since then, the differential has never risen more than 250 basis points, and right now, Fed funds rate is at 4%, and the ECB's refinance rate is at 2%, so you've got a 200 basis point pickup. And of course, then that begs the question, how much wider can that interest rate differential get? And if the Federal Reserve is going to slow down the pace of its interest rate hikes, even if they don't stop, and the ECB keeps up their pace of 75 basis points, well, then the interest rate differential is going to close. And that removes a source of demand for the dollar. And that's quite apart from the fact that we have a global inflation problem. And whereas the inflation issue in the USA is about demand, and demand is very sensitive to rising interest rates, the difficulty with inflation, particularly in Europe, but elsewhere as well, is about supply. So then interest rates don't have a big impact on supply, but the currency does. So then efforts underway by selling dollars, buying domestic currencies, should help to support the euro, the pound, the yen, and that then would help to bring down the dollar. And one of the bigger dynamic moves that we had today was in the yen. So there is increasing evidence that the peaks are in here for the dollar, and that we're going to get a deeper process of consolidation around the 150 level. So that did help to support the Nikkei. And a somewhat stronger currency has certainly been beneficial for Japanese assets. But perhaps the biggest mover over the last couple of days has been gold, and it was up $36 in here today, so pushing back up above the 1700 level. Now here we have 2 upside Q reversals and then a big upper dynamic on Friday, all from the same level. So that's really quite encouraging. And gold does tend to do best when it's appreciating in all currencies, and that is the case. Against the euro, it has been quite weak for most of this year, but certainly firming now, and also from a common level over the last 3 or 4 months. Then, if we look at it versus the pound, then we have very, I think, more convincing evidence of stronger gold performance here, and a very clear bounce from the 1400 pound level. Then let's think about the Australian dollar. Obviously, Australia is a significant gold producer and a major commodity currency, but it has been under pressure. And gold is firming now from the region of the 200-day moving average. So we certainly have evidence of gold firming in a large number of currencies. Now let's look at the one of the strongest currencies in the world this year, which was the Brazilian real. And that certainly helped to keep gold under wraps, but gold is now firming from the region of the 1,000-day moving average versus the real. So that's certainly more encouraging action. Then silver prices have also popped on the upside. So silver isn't just advancing in nominal terms, and it is now back above the 1,000-day moving average, and it's clearly above the $20 area, which was the upper side of the underlying base formation. So it did dip down into the underlying base, which I would consider to be an overshoot of the decline that we'd seen for most of this year. And then if we think about the tendency of silver to outperform in the second psychological perception stage of a secular bull market, then it's been underperforming for nearly 2 years, but it has rallied relative to gold really quite impressively this week. So now it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs, a 2 year sequence of lower rally highs, and is testing the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So this is looking certainly more encouraging for silver to resume its position as a relative performer compared to gold in a bull market environment. And platinum has cleared the $1,000 level and was up over the last few days and improved on that performance in here today. So this is also really looking quite a bit more encouraging. Gold shares, they've been impacted by the high oil price and the rather boring environment for gold, but they are acutely sensitive to the potential for offering leverage. And that's not least because oil prices were weaker in here today. So the gold ETF, or GDX, the larger cap gold miners, has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs and is firming from the $25 area. And this is looking more encouraging. Then let's think about one of the larger companies like Newmont. Well, Newmont pulled back exceptionally violently over most of this year. But then it was up rather in a rather dynamic manner in here today. But the one thing that it has going in its favor is that the yield is around 5%. And Newmont has very clearly stated that they will increase their dividend in line with their profits from gold. So then they are tying the payout to the performance of the metal. And that is the kind of thing that will attract interest in a bull market environment. Now, of course, we're in a volatile environment, and there's a lot of discussion right now going on. So the VIX index was in positive territory today, and it was down in consecutive days for most of the last month. So it didn't finish on the upper side of the daily range, and it might yet go down further. So that's a possibility. On the other hand, if the VIX finds support here, which I think is at least better than 50-50, and I don't suspect it's going to come down below 22, so we're certainly back in the region of where we might anticipate the VIX beginning to find support. Well, we're still in this developing triangular pattern, and these kinds of triangular patterns don't last indefinitely. When they break out, they do so in an exceptionally dramatic fashion. And the one thing that we have not had during this entire year of markets where stocks and bonds have and commodities have been under pressure, it's been that we have not seen a spike in volatility similar to what we had in 2015, 18, or 20. And usually, spikes up towards 50 in the VIX are coincident with major market lows. And I'm still reluctant to think that the low is in. And it would be very unlikely to go through this entire period of difficulties in the markets without having a surprise in terms of some company running into a lot of duress. High yield spreads have moderated and they're now back below the 500 basis point level. So that's positive. That is certainly something that helps to support the view that we're not going to have a very major issue in the credit markets, at least not immediately. But I am very much attuned to news about alternative assets, and I think that that is where the epicenter of risk is. There has been a huge amount of money devoted to alternative assets, and a lot of it is not going to be fruitful. Now, the 10-year yield was down 7 basis points in here today, and we're certainly seeing a pause here, but it has not yet broken the uptrend. And that suggests that we haven't quite yet seen the rollover into thinking about deflationary forces. But I do think it's coming. I think that bond yields around 4.25 are certainly more interesting. And Mrs. Tracy was very clearly saying to me yesterday that we should move all of our money out of Chase and into Capital One because the savings account that we have in Capital One was paying 10 times more interest. So that alone gives us an indication of the fact that 4% is going to be enough to encourage savers to buy, that there will be demand for a dividend or an interest payment at 4%, and certainly it will encourage savers to put their money to work. And that's likely to be a more forceful factor the higher yields go. And the reality is that it's quite normal we should see an inverted yield curve in this type of scenario, because as yields rise at the short end, then that's indirect response to interest rates. But we also know that higher interest rates curtail liquidity and make life more difficult. So then it will also have favor savers at the long end of the curve and offer a higher return, and also will start to reflect that inflationary pressures will moderate before interest rates peak at the short end, and therefore you get this inversion of the yield curve. So that's exactly what we're seeing again on the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month, and this is also exactly what we saw in 2018 and 19. And I do often enjoy Matt Levine's articles on Bloomberg, but he reposted one of his articles from 2019 yesterday, and there was a lot of speculation about the extraordinary valuations among unicorns in 2018 and 19. And the big example of that was MoviePass, where they were clearly losing money on every single subscription they sold, and yet they were able to keep going for a long time. And we had an inverted yield curve. It was very likely we were going to have a recession. And then the pandemic panic occurred, and money supply went through the roof, and valuations went up a lot. But that doesn't mean that they weren't already overvalued in 2019. So I still think that there's a lot of the overvaluation that's built up over the last decade has not been unwound. And the big challenge is that by looking at conventional economic statistics like employment, then it's crowding out the very really reality that liquidity conditions really are tightening up. Because, and the reason I say that is we have plenty of evidence of liquidity tightening up from the financial markets, and it hasn't yet followed through into the labor market. And a good part of the reason for that is because there's a clear shortage of workers, that large numbers of people retired. There hasn't been the same quantity of people entering the workforce, and then immigration has also been curtailed. And that's going to conspire to keeping wage demands higher for longer. And I think that's something that's going to contribute to the long-term trend of inflation. And that's quite apart from the fact that there are massive draws coming on the public wheel, that the outlays, both in terms of servicing the debt at these higher levels, and then also in terms of paying for social benefits and the unfunded liabilities, well, then that's a significant issue that will have to be addressed. And how they're going to do that would suggest that there's going to be both higher taxes and then also higher spending to try and get more people to work. But if you don't have the people, then you need automation. And if you can't get the automation, well, then you just need to import the people. That means that we're going to see more immigration-friendly policies coming through, at least over the next decade, if not immediately. And that's going to be, or at least if they don't come through formally, they'll come through informally. And that's true of Europe as much as it is of North America. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.